Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University, who discusses the escalating crisis in Ukraine, the threat of civil war, Russian intervention, and a new Cold War. Devin Burkhardt of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who talks about right-wing extremist groups challenging the authority of the federal government and support they now find among Republican Party elected officials. And a report on the prosecution of 14 activists who were arrested last November at the Connecticut headquarters of financial services company UBS in a protest action opposing mountaintop removal coal mining. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
April 2014 marked 20 years since the slaughter of 800,000 people in the African nation of Rwanda. The mass killings were prompted by the assassination of then-President Juvenal Habyarimana by extremist Hutus who carried out a well-planned campaign of murder targeting the nation's ethnic Tutsis. The bloodshed only ended after rebels, led by current Rwandan President Paul Kagame, fought their way to power. Today, among the bikers of Rwanda's 8 professional cycling teams, there are no Hutus or Tutsis, just Rwandans who train and play together, focused on unity and not preoccupied by the ethnic divisions of the past. Cycling team coach Felix Sampoma told the Christian Science Monitor, "When we are in other countries and people see us competing, winning, and being happy, they wonder, are these people really from Rwanda, where they are always killing each other?" Since the genocide ended in mid-July 1994, Rwanda, under Paul Kagame, has witnessed impressive economic growth. Over 1 million people have been lifted out of poverty, public schools are free, and the country has built reliable infrastructure, including broadband internet. But amid its success, the Kagame regime keeps a tight lid on dissent. A Western diplomat in the country's capital, Kigali, noted, "The government watches hawkishly for anyone who says anything that could be construed as diverting from the official party line." The New York Police Department has closed its covert program that actively tracked Muslim communities for potential terrorists in mosques and local neighborhoods. The unit, often called the Demographic Unit, was created in 2003 by a CIA agent on loan to the NYPD to flush out potential violent plots, but the undercover program failed to identify any terrorist suspects. Yet the program, exposed by the Associated Press in a 2011 article, instilled fear and resentment in local Muslim communities and lawsuits from civil liberties activists. According to the New York Times, the covert program, launched under the watch of former police commissioner Raymond Kelly, sent undercover officers to talk with Muslim shop owners, sports teams, and social clubs to gauge their sentiment on U.S. foreign policy. Incoming NYPD Commissioner William Bratton, appointed by New York City's newly elected progressive mayor Bill de Blasio, disbanded the unit and reassigned officers to the Intelligence Division. However, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the California-based Muslim Advocates, which represented 8 Muslims in a 2012 lawsuit challenging the spy program, declared in a statement that nothing in the city's announcement definitively suggests they will put an end to broad surveillance practices, which would continue to be illegal regardless of which department within the NYPD might be engaged in it. Along Draper Landing on the Dan River in northern North Carolina, a storm pipe ruptured in early February, spewing more than 30,000 tons of coal ash into the river. A plume of gray sludge ran 70 miles downstream and flowed into towns in southern Virginia. Coal ash, a byproduct of coal combustion for generating electricity, releases dangerous toxins, including arsenic, chromium, mercury, and selenium. The North Carolina pollution incident came just weeks after a massive chemical spill in West Virginia that contaminated the drinking water supply of Charlestown. While water in the Dan River was considered safe after the ash release, many citizens opted to turn off their tap water and rely instead on expensive bottled water. The two recent accidents illustrate how toxic substances are increasingly polluting America's waterways. Until the Clean Air Act of 1970, coal ash was indiscriminately burned. Now the ash is diverted to settling ponds and lagoons. In 2010, there were 300 coal ash landfills and over 580 lagoons at coal-fired power plants across the nation. According to Frank Holloman, an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, one half of all the toxic pollution of all the rivers of America comes from these plants. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Despite an agreement reached in Geneva between Ukraine, Russia, the U.S., and the European Union on April 17th, calling for all illegal groups to disarm and evacuate occupied government buildings in eastern Ukraine, recent violence has undermined the accord. On Easter Sunday, just 3 days after negotiations were concluded in Geneva, three people were reported killed in an armed attack on an eastern Ukraine checkpoint manned by activists opposed to the provisional government in Kiev. Local pro-Russian groups in Moscow say the attackers were from Right Sector, the neo-fascist group who were in the vanguard of street fighters that overthrew Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, 2 months ago. Before Yanukovych fled to Russia in February, he was the target of 4 months of militant protests in Kiev, opposing his government's decision to reject an economic agreement with the European Union. Ukraine is now in economic freefall, owing to its large debt and reliance on Russian energy. On an April 22nd visit to Kiev, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden pledged $50 million in U.S. aid to Ukraine as the nation awaits a $27 billion bailout from the International Monetary Fund. Biden called on Russia to withdraw 40,000 troops NATO says are massed along the Ukrainian border and warned of more sanctions if Moscow moved to annex Russian-speaking sections of eastern Ukraine as it did in Crimea. Your reporter spoke with John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University, who discusses the escalating crisis in Ukraine, the threat of civil war, Russian intervention, and a new Cold War.
Well, there is an article in the New York Times, and the writer of it claims to have a good reading on the Obama administration and says that the Obama administration has decided to write off Mr. Putin, is the way they put it. Whether that's accurate or not as a characterization of Mr. Obama's position, I don't know. He would probably deny that. But it does seem that we could be moving in that direction, which I think at this point is much more difficult than it would have been, you know, back in the Cold War, or if we were still in the same kind of relationship with Russia that we had then. Because we have, collaboration on the space station. You know, we can't send anything into space without the Russians. But we're working with the Russians on Syria and the chemical weapons. And there are all kinds of things that we do now. They're being very helpful in letting us get supplies in through their territory to go to Afghanistan even. Just pulling the plug on relations with Russia would be something that would be very counterproductive for the United States in many ways, and it seems to me it would behoove the United States to try to work this whole situation out in a way that doesn't overly challenge or threaten Putin, and it seems to me that the sanctions route is inappropriate.
Could there be a deal struck, you think, that would have Ukraine forego membership in NATO for the foreseeable future? Would that reduce tensions between Russia and the government in Kiev?
I think that probably would be helpful. I mean, if the NATO countries just said we're not going to push for membership for Ukraine, I mean, we've seen how risky that could be, in particular for the United States. I mean, if Ukraine had been a member of NATO a few months ago, we would have had a legal obligation, at least the way we were reading Russia's actions, we would have had a legal obligation to go in and protect Ukraine. At least Ukraine would have said we had a legal obligation. They tried that with respect to the so-called Budapest Agreement, but the Budapest Agreement isn't quite as hard and fast as the NATO treaty as a source of legal obligation to defend Ukraine.
I wanted to ask you about the economic situation in Ukraine. From what I understand, Ukraine is an economic basket case. The Russians had pumped a lot of direct aid into Ukraine through the years, and energy subsidies. Now it looks like with this pro-European government in Kiev, the United States and EU will be responsible for helping bail out Ukraine at this point. But is there some kind of possibility that Russia and EU and the United States could work together to help Ukraine and reduce the polarization in that way? In terms of Ukraine's economics, it looks like whoever's going to be the sole ally there is going to be left holding the bag in terms of pumping billions of dollars into the economy there.
Exactly. I mean, for the West, Ukraine is no prize. It's like having another Greece that needs to be given something to survive. The economic connections between Ukraine and Russia are very, very strong. A lot of the major production that Russia relies on actually comes from Ukraine, and Ukraine purchases a lot from Russia. It really isn't realistic to have an economic divorce between Ukraine and Russia. It would not be good for anybody. And clearly the West is not willing to give money to Ukraine at no cost. They're demanding quite a lot, and the Ukraine government has already been forced to increase fuel prices to the population. So we know that there can be a lot of hardship in Ukraine if something isn't worked out.
Well, any observations that you'd like to generally make about the situation there, things that are not being discussed in depth here in this country, given the tensions that we've seen rise over the recent months? And anything you'd like to throw in the mix that's not really there now?
Oh, yes, perhaps with regard to Crimea. It seems to me that it would behoove the West to indicate that that the vote that was taken in Crimea did reflect the opinion of the population there, and to back off pressuring Russia with respect to Crimea. That may already have happened in a de facto sense. This joint statement that was issued in Geneva does not mention Crimea, even though it mentions a great deal about constitutional reform domestically within Ukraine. And the fact that it is silent on Crimea really speaks volumes. But I would like to see some more attention on Crimea, in particular because there's an indigenous minority group there, the Tatars, who are very much against this project of Crimea going back to being in Russia. And they are fearful that their rights will be violated in Crimea. And I would like to see the Organization for Security and Cooperation focusing on their situation. I, in fact, worked with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in Crimea 20 years ago, and one of the things that we were focusing on at that time was the situation of the Tatars, and I think they need to be given some assurances that they're not going to be disadvantaged.
That was John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University. For more analysis and commentary on the situation in Ukraine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In two separate incidents last week, the nation was given a stark reminder of the threat posed by right-wing extremist groups who preach hate, employ violence to terrorize, and challenge the authority of the federal government with weapons. On April 13th, former Grand Dragon of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, Frazier Glenn Miller, is alleged to have shot three people to death at a Jewish community center and an assisted living facility in Overland Park, Kansas. His virulent anti-Semitism was on display as a television camera captured Miller as he yelled "Heil Hitler" while sitting handcuffed in the back of a police car. Another confrontation that gained widespread media attention took place during the second week of April, when armed militia groups rallied to support Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy when Federal Bureau of Land Management agents attempted to seize his cattle to settle more than $1 million in unpaid fines levied for his refusal to pay grazing fees over the last 20 years. Among the 1,000 protesters who came to challenge BLM agents there to carry out a court order, dozens were armed and aimed their handguns and military-style assault rifles at the federal officers from sniper positions on a nearby highway overpass. To avoid bloodshed, the BLM agents retreated and stated they'll pursue Bundy by other means. But to Bundy and the militia groups there to support him, the result of the standoff was viewed as a clear victory. Many Fox News commentators and conservative legislators lauded those participating in the uprising as heroes. Nevada's Republican U.S. Senator Dean Heller agreed, calling them patriots in response to his fellow Nevada Senator Democrat Harry Reid's labeling of the armed group as domestic terrorists. Your reporter spoke with Devin Burkhart, vice president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who talks about the danger posed by right-wing extremist groups, some of whom now receive support from Republican Party elected officials.
The echoes of Oklahoma City are still continuing to reverberate, and we're seeing a lot of the same kind of patterns today that we did back in the early 1990s, just before the Oklahoma City bombing, both in terms of the ratcheting up of the kind of paramilitary response to government activity, but also in the heightened level of violence being directed at Jews, people of color, and others in this country. So we are, you know, definitely at a heightened state of alert given what's going on both out in Nevada, but as well as what happened in Overland Park, and in incidents like that have continued to repeatedly happen for the last several years. All of them have us very much on edge, keeping a close eye on the kind of threats that are being posed to civil human rights.
Armed militia groups have come out in support of Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, basically aiming their rifles at federal agents who are trying to confiscate cattle from Cliven Bundy, who owes the government, I hear, about $1 million for grazing fees. What is the significance of this incident where you have armed groups standing down federal agents?
Well, I think what it does is that the Bundy incident has emboldened militia groups and other far-right activists who are looking for a fight with the federal government and have been preparing for armed conflict since the election of President Obama. You have literally hundreds of these local groups, some which have spun out of different local Tea Party chapters, of these individuals who are actively looking for a fight and looking to engage potentially in armed conflict with government they think has encroached too far on their liberties. Now, bear in mind, in this situation, you have a rancher who doesn't recognize at all the authority of the federal government, who has refused to pay his grazing fees for over two decades, and has in effect been, while other ranchers have paid their fees as normal, he has actively and openly challenged that the entire system unlawfully and without warrant. He's been found guilty by a number of courts, been found to be owing nearly $1 million, and yet he now becomes a symbol of somehow government overreach when they're simply trying to enforce the law.
The thing that's disturbing many people who are observing what's going on in Nevada is the fact that you have a lot of support for these armed militia groups from right-wing talk show hosts on television and radio who basically say these are real patriots, and it's very laudable that they've aimed their rifles at federal agents and dissuaded them from performing their assignment. On a similar vein, you do have many politicians around the country, extreme right Republican politicians, elected officials, who similarly back up these militia groups. Is that something new? Is that development different than things we've seen in the past?
It's eerily similar to back in the early 1990s. For instance, in this time in Nevada, you had Senator Heller, the junior senator from Nevada, openly supporting the Bundy standoff participants and calling them patriots. That's very similar to back in the early 1990s when you had militia advocates in Congress like Helen Chenoweth of Idaho and Steve Stockman of Texas, openly communicating with, participating in events and supporting the growing militia movement. So we anticipate seeing more of that, unfortunately, as these folks become more emboldened and are now actively looking for additional conflicts, you know, additional places where they can dig in and fight off the federal government and potentially, you know, get involved in a shooting war.
What should the federal government's response be here, where I'm sure officials don't want this thing to explode on many fronts around the country, but how best to defuse the situation, but also dissuade people from challenging government officials with rifles and semi-automatic weapons?
Well, I think, you know, what you've got to do is you've got to deal with it before it gets to a head. I mean, letting this, you know, simmer for 20 years clearly was part of the problem. I think another thing that the government has to look at is how to engage the Bundys and others in ways that don't lead to armed conflicts. But, you know, eventually you have to get to a situation where government can, in fact, enforce the rule of law, and that the threats, you know, coming from individuals in this instance weren't from, you know, the BLM. They were simply trying to, you know, enforce the edicts they had from the court. You had the threat of force, including sniper rifles aimed on BLM employees, coming from the militia advocates. That should be taken very seriously, and I think that law enforcement needs to take that threat seriously before more of them get shot.
That was Devin Burkhart, Vice President of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. Find links to more views and research on U.S. hate groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Fourteen activists with the group Hands Off Appalachia made their fifth court appearance on Earth Day, April 22nd, in State Superior Court in Stamford, Connecticut. The legal proceedings stem from an action last November, where some of the activists locked themselves down inside and outside the corporate office of UBS, the financial services company in Stamford, to protest the bank's financial support for mountaintop removal coal mining. The 14 are charged with trespass, breach of peace, and conspiracy. The protesters, who scaled a construction crane and unfurled a banner condemning UBS's role in mountaintop removal, were additionally charged with Trover, a legal action to recover $30,000 in damages for the time the crane could not be used by its owners. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who covered the November action and the activist's most recent court appearance, spoke first with Ricky Draper, one of two protesters who locked themselves to each other into a railing inside the UBS office. She explains why Hands Off Appalachia targeted the financial services company. In this segment, Tuhus also spoke with activist Joanne Sheehan, who explains what happened when she and two other supporters of Hands Off Appalachia attempted to deliver a letter to UBS management on Earth Day, asking the company to end its financial support for mountaintop removal coal mining.
UBS is one of the top funders of mountaintop removal coal mining, and this action came out of a campaign that we've been working on for the past 2 years called Hands Off Appalachia. And the campaign has demanded that UBS stop funding and supporting companies that practice mountaintop removal and put forward a public policy stating that they would not do business with those companies. They fund some of the worst companies, Alpha, which took over Massey's assets, Arch Coal, and Patriot Coal and James River Coal Company. And something really interesting is that UBS just recently downgraded Alpha and Arch Holdings, and that actually had a big effect on those companies.
In terms of UBS's role in mountaintop removal, my understanding is that I was down there last month, and my understanding is that mostly for economic reasons, or solely maybe for economic reasons, there's actually a lot less mountaintop removal coal mining or coal removal that's happening compared to a few years ago.
Yeah, there are new permits in every state for mountaintop removal, where mountaintop removal happens. There's started blasting again on Coal River Mountain. These areas are still very much threatened by mountaintop removal and very much threatened by the aftermath of those mines and the slurry ponds and everything in the coal processing. So, like, we've really focused on is, like, fighting so hard right now, even though we know that coal is declining and there won't be this industry much longer, but we want to target them and make them accountable while they're still in these communities. We just want to make them clean up their mess.
I was talking to somebody down there who was very experienced in coal slurry impoundments and was very worried, you know, that just that they're all accidents waiting to happen. I guess there's one that is like over a billion gallons and, you know, there's really concerns that there would be a breach.
Yeah, absolutely. They're, you know, the earthen dams. They did a large-scale test of all of these in West Virginia, and most of them failed regulation, like, or safety inspection. The one that sat above Marsh Fork Elementary School, which is right by where I live now, is 8.2 billion gallons of slurry. And it sat above this elementary school for so long until the campaign won and moved that school. But it's still over, you know, communities. And it's terrifying. No one knows what to do with that slurry.
Joanne Sheehan is a Connecticut peace activist and a supporter of Hands Off Appalachia. She and two others went to the corporate office of UBS in Stamford on Tuesday to deliver a letter asking the company to stop funding companies that conduct mountaintop removal mining operations.
Because folks were here in court today and it's Earth Day, the Hands of Appalachia wrote a letter to UBS, kind of catching up on things that have happened since they were here in November, reminding them of all of the people in Appalachia who have been really harmed through the coal mining process, mentioning that this month JPMorgan Chase updated its environmental policy that will be ending financial support and relationships around mountaintop removal, and basically asking UBS to do the same. So it's a simple letter in an envelope that wasn't sealed. We went to the main door of UBS. The security guard there simply told us that he couldn't take a letter, but told us where to go to the mailroom. And as we were going to the mailroom, security forces began to follow us. And by the time we got there, there were several police cars that pulled up and detained us. They wouldn't let us leave. And then the bomb squad came, and people from UBS with all sorts of security badges on came outside at one point. There were about 12 to 15 people, including the Stamford police supervisor, who were all there. For three people with a letter. They asked us if there were any chemicals or powders in the package. We said, there is no package, there's a letter. They never even checked the envelope. So the police officer said, well, you're the people who caused all the trouble in November. So there was clearly a concern. It was total overkill. They took our bags, they took our ID, they brought a woman police officer in and patted us down right there out on the street. So trying very hard to be intimidating, but to be honest, I felt pretty powerful standing there with two allies of Hands Off Appalachia bringing out what seemed to be half the police force and security at UBS. What are they afraid of? What are they afraid of? We have nothing to hide. We're nonviolent people. They searched our bags. They wanted to know if we had weapons. I think they knew very well that we didn't. That's not the history of anyone who has opposed UBS to use violence in any way. As a matter of fact, we're trying to stop the violence of mountaintop removal and the violence against the people in Appalachia.
That was Joanne Sheehan, preceded by Ricky Draper, one of the 14 people facing charges for a protest targeting UBS last November. During their court appearance on April 22nd, the protesters were told if they paid half the restitution the crane company says it's owed, $15,000 instead of $30,000, charges would be dropped. The activists are now considering their options. Find more information on the movement opposing mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.